Lori and I'm an alcoholic. All right. Let's see. Can you still hear me? I'm getting intimidated by this thing. All right. I'm a little nervous, so let's see. My sobriety date is July 6, 2002, and Julie, thank you for asking me to speak tonight. It is an absolute privilege and an honor to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous and to stand up here and to share my story and have all you out here as my family listen. It is, I got goosebumps right now, and it's a full moon, and I'm feeling real weepy, so if I burst into tears, it's all good. It's just part of it. I'm feeling it, so it's they're coming, and I don't have waterproof mascara on, so it might get a little ugly up here. You know, I'm laughing because when you're qualifying, you know, I'm driving to the beach today, and I'm telling my story on the way to the beach, you know, and I got that story, and then here I am up here shaking, and then there'll be the drive home where I'll be going, God, I meant to say, you know, so whatever comes out is what you guys are going to hear, so hopefully it'll reach someone. Let's see, I'm supposed to tell what happened, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And, you know, I was talking to my sponsor today, she called me, and it's so funny, I've been sober a little over 4 years, and I've told my story, you know, probably like maybe 5 or 6 times, and my story doesn't change, you know, but every time I tell it, it does. And what changes is my perception of the events that happened in my life, you know. And I remember, like, the first time that I spoke, I talked about, you know, my Leave It to Beaver childhood, and, like, you know, just, you know, it was crazy. I look back and I go, oh my God, wow. But you won't be hearing that tonight. Let's see, I was born in New York, Long Island, grew up there till I was 10, and I'm the baby of 6. Good Catholic family. My dad married my mom because he got her pregnant, so it was kind of a, you know, my mom loved him, my dad was a little, you know, he was doing his part. He was being the man, he was taking care of all these kids that he probably wished he was with somebody else, but that's okay. My mom, you know, she was awesome. She made my clothes, she designed my birthday cakes, you know, she was great. One problem, she was an alcoholic. Okay, and I don't remember her drinking because it was when I was real young, but she was also bipolar, and this is back before they, you know, diagnosed that. They just gave you shock treatment, you know, which is pretty intense. And she was very emotionally unstable, but I chose to remember the good parts of my childhood because my dad was never there for me, and if I had 2 messed up parents, you know, that was just a little bit too much for me to handle. But, you know, the truth of the matter is I was very alone growing up. My brothers and sisters were all a lot older than me, and I was so uncomfortable. I was so uncomfortable all the time. I just wanted people to love me. I wanted to feel loved. I wanted so badly for everybody just to love me. And, you know, even in school, we moved. My parents ended up getting divorced. My dad cheated on my mom for 7 years, and then my mom moved us to Florida because that was the only place that she ever felt comfortable, because we went there, you know, to Disney World. But moving here to live and going to Disney World, like, 2 different things. You guys all know because you live in Orlando. But my mom didn't know. So we moved to Cocoa Beach, and I was a little New Yorker that moved to Cocoa Beach, and they ragged on me so hard for my accent. I left school in tears every day. You know, middle school is rough. Kids are so rotten. And I was so insecure. I mean, you know, and then just to go somewhere new and have to make all new friends, it was really, really hard for me. And there was a point, and I thought about this today in 6th grade, where my initial thing, I'd go up to my friends and I'd go, are you mad at me? Hi, are you mad at me? You know, just waiting, I'm going to get that out of the way. And I remember I walked up to a group of my friends one day, and I opened my mouth, and they all looked at me and they go, are you mad at me? And I'm like, you know, I was that insecure, you know what I mean? It was just, it blows my mind. I've never felt comfortable, and I was always trying to be whoever I thought you wanted me to be was the person that I tried to be, and I was never me, and had no idea who I was, had absolutely no clue. And let's see, you know, I dibble-dabbled in drinking, like, you know, my parents would have parties or whatever, and I'd have a few drinks, but nothing until, middle school, I think I started drinking a little bit. When I had finally made my friends in Cocoa Beach that I connected with, my mom decided it was time to move again, so she moved me to Cocoa, which is a couple bridges west, and not my favorite place to go visit, but I had to go make all new friends again, and it was hard. And I remember trying to connect with people. I found one girl that, you know, I became fast friends with. We had like an assembly, and I sat next to her, and I go, "Hey, you want to be my new best friend?" She's like, "Okay." So, you know, that was that. We were best friends. And we actually hung out for a long time after that. But I remember going back to visit my friends in Cocoa Beach when I was in eighth grade. And we went to the mall, and we were drinking. You guys see those kids now at the mall. They're still there, you know? And I went there. We were drinking Boone's Farm. I think I had, or maybe it was Mad Dog 2020. It was something, but I had a whole bottle of it, and homegirl was feeling good. And I remember I was with this one girl, Paige, who used to have her brush hanging out of her back pocket. Yeah, you know, she was ballbuster, for real. You know, like, whatever she said, you did. And I was one of those people. I was a follower because I wanted to be liked. I wasn't, you know, I just wanted people to like me. So I did basically whatever I felt that if I did, that they would like me. So we were at the mall, and this Berlinetta pulls up, and my friend Paige is like, "We're going with these guys." And I'm like, "No, we're not." You know, like, "You can go." She's like, "No, you're coming with me because this friend likes you." I'm in eighth grade, and I'm drunk. And so anyway, she pulls me into the car with her, and we went and we parked under a bridge, and they kept feeding me more beer, and I passed out. And in my blackout, pass-out state, I had my first sexual experience. And I can say that, and I can stand up here, and you know what? It doesn't hurt anymore. It's so cool that I can stand up here and I can share that with you, not for your sympathy, but that, so I can tell you how this started for me. And what that experience took for me was what little bit of self-esteem I had left was pretty much gone, because I felt really damaged after that. I mean, so that kind of set the standard for my future relationships. And I went home, and I remember I wasn't feeling real good about myself. And I went into high school, and I used to walk around with my head down, and I just felt like, you know, just so unworthy. And I had a couple girls, though. I ended up being a cheerleader in high school, and I had some older girls that were very positive and loving, and they were like, "Oh, you should run for class president. You should, you know, you should do this, you should do this." And I'm like, "Oh, I could never do that. I could never do that." And they really encouraged me and supported me, and I did, and I won. And so I was freshman class president, and I was a cheerleader, and I was doing well in school. And I like to drink, though, on the weekends, you know. And I would Rain? Sweet. All right. I'm like, okay, you guys all heard it too, right? Okay, I'm not crazy. All right. But I, you know, I like to drink. And I mean, even back in high school, I would go and people would have a beer and I would have a bottle. You know, it was never normal drinking for me. And I was a blackout drinker right out the gate, you know. And it made me comfortable. It made me comfortable in social settings. I didn't care anymore. I felt beautiful. I felt like I could, you know, get your boyfriend. I felt like I could do whatever I needed to do, and I just felt okay. I finally felt okay. And I remember that I didn't really, I smoked pot, whatever, but I didn't really drink a whole lot in high school because I was more concerned with boys and what else? Oh yeah, my mom got really, really sick when I was the summer of my junior year, and she was diagnosed with a tumor on her kidney. And it ended up, it was benign, but it was so big that they had to take the kidney out. And you know, go back into my relationship with my mother a little bit. My mom told me way too much for a kid to hear. You know, I knew way too much. I knew that we didn't have money for this, or that we didn't have money for that, or that my dad did this. And, you know, I was kind of put in the middle. I was my mom's confidant instead of being able to be a kid. And my mom didn't drink, but she started smoking pot. And so I used to go buy my mom bags in high school. And, you know, when I was in high school, though, I had the cool mom. Everybody wanted to come to my house because my mom could roll a joint with one hand. And I know this is AA and I'm talking about pot, but you know what? Both of the co-founders did drugs, and I'm not going to talk about it a whole lot, but this is just part of my story. So if I offend anybody, I'm terribly sorry. Anyway, but I shared that with my mother, you know, and that's not, you know, that's not normal. You know, normal, like, I have a 3-year-old. I don't ever plan on, you know, asking him to go buy me a bag of pot. You know, could you go drive into that really bad neighborhood over there and score me some weed, please? You know. But at the time, it was just my life, and it's the way that things were. But my mom got really, really sick, and she was the only normal, stable thing that I had in my life, and I freaked out. I absolutely freaked out because my dad was never there. My mom's really sick, and my mom was, she was kind of a hypochondriac anyway, so it was like just my friends. My senior year of high school, I was changing catheter bags and administering narcotics, and it was pretty heavy. They gave her a couple months to live after they took her kidney out, and she kept going, man. I don't know how, but she kept living. But it was really, really hard because her liver would secrete ammonia, and it would go to her brain, and it was like LSD, so she would hallucinate. And I remember she told my brother, Jimmy, that I came to see her in the hospital, and I was laughing at her, and that my head was the size of a light bulb, and that I was a Satan worshiper, and all this crazy stuff. And, you know, and the fact that my brother called me to ask me if I was, I'm like, okay, Jimmy, yeah, that's me. No, but it was difficult to see the state that she was in, and it was also difficult because I was so absolutely dependent on her for everything. I didn't know how to do anything on my own, and I was so afraid of losing her. And I remember by that point when my mom got sick, that's when my drinking really accelerated, because it was a way to numb what I was going through. And when I turned, I think it was like right after my 18th birthday, my mom was, she'd gotten out of the hospital, and she'd been in there for a long time, and my sisters came down, and one from New York and one from Colorado, and they went to dinner and didn't invite me, and my feelings got all hurt, so I went out and I got drunk. And I was the girl at the party that you wanted me to be on your drinking team, you know, because I mean, I was good. I could drink me some booze, you know, and I was winning all kinds of drinking games that night. And I remember there was a point in the night where we hid my keys, and then a later point in the night, you know, I was like, sure, I don't want to drive. And then later on, I was like, give me the keys. I got to go home. I got to see my mom. And they wouldn't give me the keys. They gave them to my girlfriend, Deanne, and they'd let her drive. And I told her she couldn't drive my car. Give me the keys. And I took the keys from her, got behind the wheel, and I drove home, and I went over the bridge, and I stopped at a red light. The only problem was I was in the middle of the intersection when I stopped. So kept going, and then I took a left turn on US 1 and did a 360. And at that point, she was like, okay, so now you're going to pull over, and you're going to let me drive, right? And I'm like, okay. So I went to her house, and I fought her. I didn't care. I just wanted to go home, and I wanted to see my mom, and she didn't want her dad to know we were drinking, so she seatbelted me in, and I left. And I wrecked in her neighborhood. And I smashed my Fiero, y'all know the size of those cars, into a parked car and pushed it across the street into a tree. I ripped my nose off from here down all the way across, crushed my septum, and don't remember any of that because that all happened in a blackout. But I remember waking up in the hospital, and I had, you know, fractured ribs, and I'm just kind of like, what the hell happened to me? And I looked in the mirror, and I was like, holy crap. I looked like so scary. My eyes were black, and they were sunken, and my nose was just like this big, and I had all these stitches, and I was hungover on top of it, you know. To add insult to injury, man, it really sucked, you know. And I remember that my brother and my sister came in and they gave me this little Maggie Simpson doll, which was cool because she was the baby, you know. So, not that that made me feel any better. It certainly didn't. But I remember leaving the hospital and I had to go heal from that. And I've already, you know, sporting the low self-esteem. Now I've really got low self-esteem because I look like absolute crap. And I remember that my girlfriend Lori picked me up, the one that I befriended in middle school, and I said, Lori, I want you to be honest with me. I said, am I ugly? And she got real quiet, and she looked at me and she goes, well, you're not ugly, but you're never going to look like you used to. And I really lost it because at that point in my life, I thought that my looks kind of validated who I was. I didn't think I had a whole lot going on, but I thought I was reasonably attractive. So that was, you know, and now that's gone too. And at that point, it was more of just a lot of pain. And I healed from that pretty quickly. I had a big scar. But I had a plastic surgeon that was on call at the hospital, so, you know, and you can barely tell now. I got a nice bump, but it healed nicely. But for a long time, I looked really bad, and any guy that would pay me any attention, I was so happy because I felt that bad about myself. I'm like, oh, wait, I'm not too ugly? Oh, okay. So, you know, that's where I was emotionally. I just wanted somebody to fix me. I wanted somebody to heal me and make me feel better. And at that point I moved back to New York for my first geographical. And I lived there for, almost a little over a year. And I did well. I was still drinking like a fish, worse than ever up there probably. But I needed to prove to myself that I would be okay without my mom. You know, it was like my proof to myself that I would be okay without my mother because I knew she was dying. And I think right before I moved to New York, I forgot to tell this, but right before I moved to New York, I came home one night drunk, and I just wanted the pain to stop. You know, I wanted the pain to stop so bad. And I ate whatever I could find. I found a bottle of some random pink tablets, and I ate those and couldn't find anything else. So I took some rat poison, and I put that in with some Slim Fast and some milk, you know, total drunk cocktail. And I know, it's sad. And so I drank my Slim Fast rat shake, and I lost 2 pounds. No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding. Almost lost more than that. But I went in my room and I put a plastic bag over my head and I duct taped it. And I laid there and I wanted to die. I just wanted the pain to stop. And I couldn't handle suffocating, so I ripped the bag open, and then I threw up the pink pills all over my carpet in my bedroom. And then I went and I knocked on my mom's door, and I said, Mom, I just tried to kill myself. And she said, I know. And I said, why didn't you try to stop me? And she said, well, I figured if you wanted too bad enough that I wasn't going to be able to stop you. And you know, that was I really, more than anything, I didn't want to die. I didn't know how to live. I didn't want to feel the pain anymore. And when I moved to New York, I lived there for a while, like I said, you know, did some heavy drinking. Not a whole lot of amends that I had to make up there, which is kind of good. But actually, I did leave my roommate hanging because I remember speaking to my mom. I was so lonely up there. All my friends are in Florida. Everybody in New York was like fast-paced kind of attitude, and I'm laid-back Florida girl. You know, I'm like, no, it's all good. And they're like, no, it's not. Okay, so I remember I called my stepdad and I talked to him and I said, I really want to come home. And I had a good job. I was working for Chase Auto Finance up there. They were going to pay for my school and I had a nice house, you know, that I was renting and things were going good finally. And I had to come home. My mom was in the hospital 23 days and I spoke to her on the phone and it was the most coherent she'd been. And she said, Lori, stay up there. Give it 6 more months. You'll meet some people. It'll be fine. And, I just told my stepdad, I'm like, I'm coming home. He's like, well, fine, you got a place to stay. So I packed all my stuff in Glad bags, my matching luggage, plus, very nice, loaded up my Monte Carlo, and I was back on 95. And the whole ride home, I'm flipping out because I know that I've almost got my crap together, almost, for the first time, and I'm leaving it all behind. So every exit, I'm like, you know, like ready to get off. And I remember I was listening to Elton John. I flipped the tape and a thought that didn't coincide with anything that I was doing. It said, Lori, all you have to do is go home and tell your mom that God loves her and everything's going to be okay. And that was the first spiritual experience I've had in my life. And the whole ride home, I did not look in the rearview mirror. I went home. And I tell that now because that was such a gift to me. That was such a gift to me because when I got home, my mother died the day after I got home. And I went to the hospital and I was able to go brush her hair and read to her and be with her and spend a day with her. And then I went out and I got drunk because I'm an alcoholic and I couldn't handle it, you know. And my family was kind of disappointed that I left my job and yada, yada, yada. And it was a little bit of judgmental stuff going on when I got home, but my mom died, and that absolutely fueled my drinking, because now, I mean, if I wasn't a victim before of life, I was the biggest victim ever on the planet, and I would just, you could hear the little violin playing when I would walk into the room, because it was just, my life was so tragic. But, and I'm saying that jokingly, so you guys can laugh if you want to. It really wasn't, but at the time it was. So anyway, I had my first AA meeting when I was 18 and I had to. Oh, because did I mention I got a DUI when I wrecked my car? Yeah, that was DUI number one. And I say number one because obviously there's more than one. Yeah, so I had my first AA meeting back when I was 18, and I was like, oh yeah, I'm home, but you know, I gotta go drink some more, so I'll see y'all later. And anyway, when I moved back, after my mom died, I moved to Cocoa Beach. My stepdad helped me get a place out there, and I started working in a restaurant. And I'm trying to think. Wait. I forgot to mention DUI number two. Let's go back to that story. Huh. 21st birthday, yeah? Okay, yep. Leaving a bar, parked in front of the police station under a street light. So bright. I'm such a bright girl. And left in platforms. Yeah, so I got DUI that night. So we saw that one coming. I don't know what I was thinking when I parked there. But anyway, so thank God it didn't hurt anybody. You know, I can laugh about it now because you know what? I did a lot of community service. I paid a lot of fines. And I, you know, I've made restitution for that. And I thank God that I didn't hurt anybody, because God's grace is that I only have 3 DUIs instead of the 85 million times that I've driven drunk. You know what I mean? So I should be a convicted felon right now, but I'm not, by God's grace. So anyway, moved to Cocoa Beach, and I just I remember I stopped drinking for 30 days after that, and I would go to these, I would go to bars and be like, yeah, I'm not drinking. I'll take a near beer. I'll take it. Yeah, like, you know. And it was like 30 days. If I could just make that 30 days, then I'm good. I'm golden, right? And I made the 30 days, and I celebrated with some Rum Runners. And lots of them. And some other stuff. And, let's see. I ended up, I met a guy when I was 22. And I thought that my mother sent him to me, you know, because he had blue eyes like my mom, and I just instantly fell in love with him. And he's a dear friend of mine to this day, but he's an alcoholic too. When we were together, we liked to drink a lot, so it was a very unhealthy relationship. And I went out with him for 3.5 years, and It got ugly. Like, I used to get drunk and hit him and go crazy and do stupid alcoholic things. And, like, you know, like we all do. I won't go into all the stories, but I got some good ones. But I'll spare you. We went out. Things, you know, went bad. They went south. And I was getting evicted from my apartment. I had gotten fired from my job. And I was, you know, I was thinking, God, you know, maybe I have a problem with alcohol. I don't know. So I called my sister who lived in Vail, and I said, Judy, can I come live with you? And I have no idea. She said, yes. God bless her, because I moved to Vail. And if you're trying to sober up, I definitely don't recommend moving to a ski resort. It just doesn't work. And I moved there, and I just found people that drank just like me, just somewhere else, you know, and earlier, because Opry Ski starts at 3, and happy hour starts at 5 here. So I just, you know, I wouldn't even go up on the mountain. I would just start drinking. But I remember being there, and the thing that sucked about being there is nobody knew me. So I just, you know, I went there, at least in Cocoa Beach, I could get drunk and people would take care of me because it's where I grew up, it's where my friends were, and I could just be, you know, a wreck, and somebody would always take care of me and take me home. And when I lived there, I would get drunk, and I would get on the wrong bus, and I'd be in the middle of the road, and it'd be snowing, and I'm just like, you know, God, help me. And, I, you know, how I survived all that absolutely blows my mind. It really does. But I wreaked havoc in my sister's life, and we're so close now, and that is one of the blessings of the program, and I'll get to that. But when I lived there, I was an absolute mess. I mooched off of her and her husband, and I didn't pay any money, and I lived there, and I remember I was going to try to make it up to her, because I was such a mooch. So I said I would watch her son, and I'd babysit him on Valentine's Day so her and her husband could go have dinner. And they came home, and I got drunk, and I passed out. And they came home, and they couldn't wake me up. And they, you know, and my little nephew was up in his crib, but still in his clothes, with the, you know, the fuzzy screen because the movie stopped. And nothing happened, but that's not the point. You know, anything could happen, and I was not there. I was there, but I was not there. Couldn't even wake me up. And they kicked me out after that. And I went into, you know, I couldn't understand why they just couldn't understand me, you know. But mom died, and it's so tragic. And, you know, nobody loves me, and they're like, you gotta go. You need, like, bye. So I went down to the store, and I got some sleeping pills, over-the-counter ones, and I ate a bunch of them, and, like, 2 boxes, I think. And then I started having trouble breathing. And, you know, I didn't want to die again. I just wanted the pain to stop. I just wanted somebody to come and fix me, because I knew there was something tragically wrong with me. I just couldn't pinpoint it for some reason, you know? So I thought maybe if I ate these sleeping pills, maybe I would just go to sleep and then things would be okay. And I remember my sister's a nurse, and I went out there. I'm like, Judy, I just ate a bunch of sleeping pills, and I'm having trouble breathing. So she put me in the car in a blizzard, drove me to the hospital where she works, and admitted me for, you know, taken a bunch of sleeping pills, and they gave me some delicious charcoal. I don't know if anybody's had the pleasure of drinking that, but that's fabulous. And I got to stay there overnight and stay in a room, and I finally felt safe. And I did not want to leave the hospital. I swear I didn't. I was like, oh, I could just watch TV and sit here, and everything's okay, and I don't have to go back out into the world. But they released me, and I moved out, and I started just, you know, burning through jobs and just drinking heavy, and people didn't want me around because I was a drunk and I was a nightmare. And I would get paid on Friday, and I'd have all that money would be gone. I would drink it all the whole weekend or whatever. And I remember I was at this bar on like a Saturday day, this place, Bob's Place. That's where I hung out, at Bob's Place. And I would shoot pool. And it was Saturday in the afternoon, and I met this girl who I was playing pool against, and she was in AA. And I was like, you're in AA? I'm like, wow. And I ended up exchanging phone numbers with her and this other girl. And I don't know, maybe a month later or something, I woke up one day at 3, and I was supposed to be to work at 10. So, yeah, I didn't have that job anymore. And I had lots of jobs in Vail. I think I worked at every restaurant there. But the pain was great enough. You know, I mean, at this point, I would wake up and, you know, I never threw up at night. I would throw up the next day, though, which is lovely. You know, bile's fabulous. And my eyes, I used to lay on my couch with those little Pond's cucumber slices on my eyes, or like tea bags or whatever, you know, because my eyes were so freaking puffy, man. They were so out of control puffy. I looked like crap all the time. I shook, you know, and I was a mess. I was dying from alcohol, and I didn't even know it. I had no freaking idea. And, you know, I worked at this bar, and I would go in, and I'm like, if I'm working a double, like, just make it to my break, and then I can go do a shot, and then I'll stop shaking. You know, and if I serve people fast enough, they won't see my hands as I'm trying to put their food down in front of them. And I ended up, after I burned through that last job, I woke up, and I called, my friend, and she took me to an AA meeting, and I got this book there at that meeting, and it was there was only 4 people, man, but it was so cool because I finally felt like I was home. You know, people finally understood me. I must have smelled like a friggin' gin mill or something. I don't know. And I'd like to say that was my last drink, but obviously it wasn't because I was in 98. But at that point, I was one of those hard-headed people, you know, and I didn't realize that those 12 steps over there on the wall, like you're supposed to get a sponsor and work them and stuff, and you're supposed to stop doing drugs too, because I thought that I could just, like, because alcohol was my problem, it really was, so if I put down the drink, problem solved, right? So wrong. That is so not the case. And I get a little frustrated. I was in a meeting the other night, and somebody was saying, oh, just don't drink and go to meetings. And I'm like, what? People die from that advice. This is not the program of recovery that's in this book. You know? If self could overcome self, then we wouldn't need this program, you know? But anyway, I'll get on my soapbox in a minute. Let me go ahead and get you down to no, I'm just kidding. But so anyway, got kind of sober in Vail, moved back to Cocoa Beach to finish school, and was doing okay there. I was doing well in school. I was trying to control my drinking, so I would not drink for like a big spurt, and then I'd go and I'd get totally bombed and like piss a bunch of people off, and then wouldn't drink, and you know, it was just absolute alcoholic behavior. And I found my next victim boyfriend, and God love him, you know. But thank God, his dad was an alcoholic, and his mom was
had split personality, so he was like, I was like his cup of tea, man. He was like, yeah, that's my dream girl right there. God, you know? He was right at home with me. But, you know, he had his own issues. He was pretty sick, too, in his own way. But he just, you know, when he met me, I wasn't drinking. So when I started drinking after we started going out, because I'm like, all right, I got a boyfriend, I can start drinking again. And then he got to see what I was like when I was drunk, and he didn't like it. So we went through some, stuff, and I remember that we were having some problems, and once again, I got drunk, really drunk, and somebody took advantage of me again, and I went to his house and knocked on his door, and I told him what happened to me, and I said, I woke up with that guy on top of me, and that's what alcohol does to me, and I need help. And he said, I can't be around you right now. So he dropped me off at my house, and I went inside, and I slipped my wrist. And I just wanted the pain to stop, you know? I really did. And he came through my bathroom window, and I got taken off in the ambulance, and I'm such a great alcoholic that I got in there, and I was just like, oh, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I just fell off the wagon. It's all good. I'm going right back to AA, and they released me. And I'm like, oh, my God, I don't want to go back out into the world yet. Wait. So I stayed. But all these things that happened to me, it took every single one of those things happening to me to get me here today. You know, I wasn't one of those, like, high-bottom cases that was still functioning and still had a job and all that. I mean, I had to go through, like, huge things, and it still did not dawn on me that I could not drink safely. Pretty thick-headed, you know? And the cool thing is my roommate Gwen ran over this purse in the road, and she came home. And I had tried to get sober in Cocoa Beach, kind of sort of got a sponsor, kind of sort of started working the steps a little, sort of, just a bit. Kind of went to more meetings than anything else, you know. Because you're just supposed to not drink and go to meetings, right? Right? Wrong. Anyway, it didn't work. But my roommate ran over this person. She came home, and I said, well, let's open it up and see whose it is. And it was somebody from the program. I'm like, great. I got to call this lady. Here I am. I'm back out, and I got to call her up, you know, and tell her we got her purse. But I knew I was moving to Orlando to finish school at UCF, and I met with her for lunch, and I said, I'm moving to Orlando, and I think I want to get sober. I think I need to. And she says, I hear my friend Julie lives there. Let me give you her phone number. And you guys probably know her if she's a member of this group. And she's my sponsor today. And that was God doing for me what I could not do for myself. And he put this amazing woman in my life who I didn't call when I moved to Orlando because I was still going to, you know, do things my own way. And I got drunk again. And then I, you know, created some more drama. And then I called Julie. And my last drink in Orlando was on September the 11th, 2001, the night before. I got totally bombed, and I woke up and I had no idea that what was going on in the world. I had no idea that the Twin Towers had fallen, that my brother's a rescue on firefighter and he's there. Totally oblivious to it. I'm hungover. And so my sobriety date was September 11th, and I was like, wow, how cool is that? My sobriety date, you know, total ego. Like, you know, the world's falling to crap. Lori comes out of the ashes sober, you know. I mean, I was just like, God totally knew that that wasn't going to work for me. No way. No way. So, needless to say, you know, I started working with Julie, and but I got caught up in fellowship with the little F. I got caught up in going to meetings and going to Starbucks and doing all those important social things and not doing the program as it's outlined in the book. Not, you know. And the funny thing is, step one, you know, tells us in the book that we have to concede to our innermost selves that we cannot drink safely. And every time I quit, I meant it, you know? But I had not conceded to my innermost self that I could not take a drink without impunity. But that time when I woke up, my last drink was on my 30th birthday. And it was my 30th birthday, and it was raining. I had a Dave Matthews concert, and everybody was drunk. Everybody was drunk, and they were all high, too. I know it. And I was so bad. I was, like, the whole war's going on in my head, you know? And I grabbed the joint out of this guy's hand, and I remember, you know, that's not a good thing to relapse on, because now I'm, like, 20,000 people. They all know I relapsed. You know, I'm all paranoid. It was out of control. But I have not had a drink since July 6, 2002. And when I got back, you know, I called Julie on my way home from that, because nothing changed. Nothing horrible happened that night, but it was the same thing. You know, it was the same damn thing. Nothing changed. And I said, all right, obviously I'm doing something wrong in my program if I got drunk again. You know? So, I went home, and I finished working the steps, and I changed my attitude about the program. You know, I started taking direction a bit better, and I remember I was about 6 months sober, and I decided that I wasn't gonna date, and then I got pregnant, and So I put the cart before the horse on that one, you know, because at that point I was still managing my own life, and I thought, you know, God's doing a great job with everything else, but let me go ahead and I'll work on the man thing, you know, and I can just find someone and, okay, you'll do. And, but he saw fit to make, well, I mean, he didn't make me pregnant. I made me pregnant, but I conceived a child on that night. You know what? And my sobriety absolutely shifted on that day, because I had gotten fired from my job, and now I'm pregnant, and I've got 6 months sober. And I was like, wow, I'm having a kid. This is freaky. And it's so not about me anymore, you know? And Asher, my son, is going to be 3 on the 18th. He has absolutely changed my life, you know. This program has absolutely changed my life. Having him, you know, getting pregnant, I remember Julie was like, oh my God, why can't you learn from my mistakes? You know, and I don't learn from anybody's mistakes. I don't even learn from my own mistakes. What I learn from is living with the consequences of the choices that I make. And I've made some probably, you know, there's no bad choices. There's just been a little bit difficult consequences, you know? Difficult consequences. But the cool thing is, my experience has helped other alcoholics. I've been able to reach out to other women that are going through similar things and go, hey, you know what? I made it through that and I didn't drink. I made it through this and I didn't drink. You know, and when I talk about you know, being raped or anything like that, when I did my fourth step, I was able to forgive. Because when we say in the Lord's Prayer at the end, you know, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. So if I'm not forgiving, then I'm not going to be forgiven. And I want to be forgiven today. You know? And it freed me. It freed me when I did that. When I could let that stuff go. And I didn't have to be bondage of that. You know? And I could be free from that. And, you know, the longer that I stay sober, it's so funny, but, it's more about my character defects today than it is about anything else. It's not about the drink, you know? The obsession of drink left when I had my spiritual awakening. It's gone. But today, you know, this book tells me that my problem isn't alcohol. My problem is my lack of power. And the way for me to find that power is through working the 12 steps in this book, exactly how they're laid out. No bells and whistles. When I take somebody through the steps, I do it exactly the way it is in this book. And, you know, I was sitting out in the ocean today. You know, I remember when I first got sober, I was so scared that I wasn't going to have any fun, I wasn't going to be able to live, and I wasn't going to be able to do anything. And you know what? I was not living when I was drinking. I was not living. I was hiding from everything. And today, I live. I do things. I don't sit in a bar and talk about all the things I'm going to do. I actually do them. You know, and I was sitting in the ocean today, and I was surfing, and I was waiting for a set, and I was like, now, why can't I just be this patient with everything else in my life? When I'm waiting for the next set in my life, why can't I just be like, la, la, look how beautiful it is, you know? So I'm going to try to remember that the next time I'm in the hallway and I'm waiting for God to, you know, unfold the next thing, because I'm not in management anymore, you know? Today I just try to roll with it. And where's the page? I marked all this stuff, and now my little thing slipped out, so hang on a second. Says, it is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve, contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day, not Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are the thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It is the proper use of the will, and I had no idea that that was the proper use of the will until I worked the steps. You know, I thought I could pray to God and give him my wish list or whatever, and you know what? You know, it's not about that. It's trusting an infinite God rather than my finite self, trusting that he knows what's best for me, and it may be uncomfortable. There's been a lot of uncomfortable times. Asher's father, who's in this program too, we're not together anymore. That was not an easy choice that I had to make. It was the best choice for both of us. It was really hard. And wait a minute. It says right here on page 14, it says, for if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die, and faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. Certain trials and low spots ahead, that's a guarantee that my life is going to have another rough patch. You know, we don't get sober and everything's, you know, sunshine, rainbows, and we're all outside singing Kumbaya in a circle. I mean, it's, you know, but I have a spiritual toolkit. Alcohol was my solution to everything for years and years, you know, and today I have a higher power that runs my life, and my solution is right there, and I continually work the steps with my sponsor, you know, especially when I don't want to. And my life has just, you know, if I think back to like when I was a year sober and all I really wanted was like a job and like, you know, like a boyfriend and like, you know, a car and, you know, and I look at my life today and God's grace and the blessings in my life are, they like bring me to tears, man. I start every day on my knees. And I do my tenth step. I say the third and the seventh step prayer. And when I end my day, I do my tenth step on my knees again. You know, it is that important. Because I have to keep that conscious contact with God, and I have to keep a grateful heart. Because this thing can go bye-byes, and I'll be drunk and on the street in no time. You know, I've got to remember that this is a daily reprieve. And I'm sorry if I rambled at all. I don't know. I was trying. I didn't want it to sound contrived, so I just kind of went with it. So whatever came out, whatever happened. It is always an honor to share my story, and I love Central Group. My home group is Decisions in Tuscaloosa, but I've been like teetering whether I want to make Central my home group. So starting right now in front of you guys, Central's my home group now. So if anybody has any service work, commitment that you want to give me, talk to me. I still got to go to one of those meetings, though, on a Sunday. But my office is over there, and I come to a lot of meetings here, and there's a lot of really good sobriety in this room. And this program has changed my life. If you're a newcomer and you haven't worked the steps yet, then you're not doing the deal, and you're not going to have a spiritual awakening by coming here and going to meetings and hanging out talking outside. It just doesn't happen that way. I wish that half measures availed something, but they don't. They avail us nothing. So you can do half and get none, or you can do all 12 and just be rocketed into the fourth dimension. Thanks for letting me share.